Opening bell in about 20 seconds. Let me just set the stage for you.
Money, money, I want more money.
You cannot have it all.
This whole system is too confusing.
Hi, I'm Ben White, and this is Politico Money. We're joined by Andrew Ross Sorkin, my former colleague at the New York Times. He's host of CNBC's Squawk Box. He literally wrote the book on the financial crisis, Too Big to Fail, has a new edition out now with a new foreword.
Afterword.
To get us up to speed on what has happened 10 years later after the financial crisis. A lot of retrospectives going on right now, but Sorkin is the man to talk to about this. So let's just go back, rewind 10 years.
It was a manic Monday in the financial markets.
It's very mysterious. People just walk around, not sure what's happening. Some people are wrapping up all their belongings.
This is an extraordinary period for America's economy. Over the past few weeks, many Americans have felt anxiety about their finances and their future.
Oh my goodness, I remember talking to people on Wall Street who were sending, this is going to sound sexist, they were sending their wives to the banks to literally go to ATM machines to take all their cash out. It was remarkable. I mean, there were people who truly believed, and I believe, that we were on the cusp of an economic abyss. And that's something I'm not sure the general public has ever fully appreciated, just how deep and how far this crisis could have gone. And without that understanding, I think it's very difficult to look at today and say, oh, this is so great.
And I remember I was at the FT when the Bear Stearns hedge fund problems happened. It was right before I jumped over to the Times. And I did think at that point, okay, Bear is in trouble, but this is going to be relatively isolated, and that Lehman wouldn't get into the kind of trouble that it ultimately did. And as you say, there were people who, in retrospect, say they claimed they knew that it was going to happen.
You know, people, by the way, just to put a fine point on that, even the weekend of Lehman Brothers thought, even the Monday morning after Lehman Brothers collapsed and went bankrupt, thought that things were going to be okay. In fact, all the CEOs around the room were telling policymakers that they were set up for this. The op-ed page, the editorial page on the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal the day after Lehman Brothers collapsed praised the policymakers as if it was a great decision. And the markets in the morning did not move in a negative way. It really was only after that the cataclysmic systemic nature of it really became as apparent as clearly as to us all now.
Yeah, I'll say the one moment where I really started to get scared, and you may know the exact date of this, and I'm not going to remember it offhand, but it was when Chuck Prince said at Citigroup at the time, he was the CEO of Citigroup.
Fine.
Yeah, people were asking him about subprime mortgages and underwriting securities backed by subprime mortgages. And clearly, Chuck Prince knew there was a problem here. He said, but as if the music is still going, we got to keep dancing. Yeah. And that gave you the sense that this music is going to stop. Yeah. And when it stops, a lot of people are going to be in trouble. So that was kind of a signal to me that everybody who was in a position of power in Wall Street knew that there was an issue here, that everybody was levered, meaning they'd borrowed a ton of money. And, you know, if there were a crisis in subprime mortgages, that there would be a lot of issues. So let's...
But I will go so far as to suggest that I don't believe even Chuck Prince, when he said that, understood the severity of what he was saying. Meaning, yes, the music would stop and there would be a problem. But if that was true, meaning if Chuck Prince really knew that, he would have sold every share of his Citigroup stock. He would have shorted financial companies. He would have done about 100 things that he didn't do. And so, yes, you could argue that the incentives were there for everybody to keep this gravy train rolling as long as possible. Goldman, by the way, of all the firms, was probably, in terms of best positioned, who might have thought there could be a problem, to have tried to do something about it and did, by the way. And then, of course, it was argued that they injured everybody else in the process. But nonetheless, it's just a point I wanted to bring in.
Yeah, no, you mentioned Goldman and, you know, the famous Gary Cohn line talking about how he made $375 million in one day for Goldman by shorting the mortgage market. So arguably they saw it coming and took steps to profit off it. All right, let's talk about our time together at the times, as this was all going on, it was a pretty insane place to be, you know, in the front seat covering this thing. And, you know, I was talking to Lehman Brothers executives all the time, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the weird stuff that they said to me on the phone. But what did you see as sort of the weirdest behavior that you found odd while you were covering this? What kind of jumped out at you as like, these people are strange?
You know, it wasn't so much unusual behavior so much as it clarified a sense of who was telling the truth and who wasn't, how emotional this was for so many people. I remember right around the week that Bear Stearns was getting into trouble, just the number of people who would flat out lie in a way that they historically didn't. It actually, and then again in September 2008, I remember talking to an executive, I won't say which firm, who I've known forever, had been a source, had been helpful. It's been someone I actually trusted relatively implicitly, and literally just straight up bald-faced lied. And I called him on it a couple months later after it had happened and said, "How? What?" And he said, "The firm was going to go down. I couldn't tell you that." And that to me really, really represented sort of the straits that this industry was in at that time.
I had the same experience, and I'm going to go ahead and name the firm. It was Lehman Brothers. I don't think it will shock anybody to hear that. I won't name the executive or executives, but they told me bald-faced lies about their financial condition. And you know, I think they truly believed, at one point at least, that you know they could make enough moves to shore up their financial position. It was clear that they couldn't. The other moment that always stands out to me from our time at the Times was the day of the TARP vote in the House of Representatives.
Watching that TV screen. Yeah. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do remember it. And, you know, I'm thinking to myself, these guys can't possibly vote this down because, sure, it's hugely unpopular to throw a bunch of cash at Wall Street banks to keep them from failing. But if you don't do that, things are going to get a hell of a lot worse. Looks like, and eventually the House does vote down TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, the Wall Street bailout, and the market absolutely crashes. That's when I thought, like, you know, this is really bad. We're in for a cataclysmic crisis that nobody's going to be able to get through unscathed. What was that day like for you?
You know, there was a 2-week period which included that day where I thought the world was on fire. I remember when Lehman Brothers went under, that night being at home or going home probably at 2 o'clock in the morning after Lehman had filed, and waking up my wife to tell her, "You're not going to believe what just happened." And so I remember there were just so many moments throughout that week, the week after, the weekend that Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley were literally on the cusp of falling. I don't think we appreciated, by the way, that the dominoes after Goldman and Morgan was General Electric. This is a company, a global company with 300,000 employees around the world. I mean, I don't think that these are the parts of the crisis that I don't think in the moment contemporaneously the public ever really felt.
Yeah. And did it impact you personally? Like it did for me. Like I went into a pretty serious depression and it definitely affected my home life. And, you know, I had to take some time off after all of this happened because it really kind of shook me to the core. And it wasn't just that, there was other stuff going on, but like, did it have a personal effect on you? I mean, you're a pretty even keeled guy. You've seen ups and downs.
Look, not to make this a completely personal story, the Friday before Lehman Brothers failed, my grandfather died.
I was going to ask you about that.
And, he died in the morning, and I remember the phone call with my father forever. And we talked about Poppy, Sidney Sorkin, to me, and what he would have wanted me to do. And I was talking to my father about just how emotional this moment was and how important it was historically. And should I be covering it? What should I be doing? And Sidney was a man who loved to read history books, and he would have loved this. He would have loved to cover this. And so, of course, that's what I did. I think that, you know, when I was in the moment, those 2 or 3 or 4 weeks of just complete craziness, I don't think I ever had enough, frankly, perspective to really understand what was happening to me personally in any way. It was probably only after that. And then I ran almost a, like a all-out sprint of a marathon to write this book that same year. So I don't think I ever really took a breath, unfortunately, for almost 365 days before I think I could just say to myself, oh my God, I can't believe that just happened.
Yeah, I totally agree with the adrenaline-fueled rush of the, you know, the worst moments of it. I think it was after that when it sort of had crested and TARP had passed. That's when it kind of hit me, the depth of what had happened and how many people had been hurt by it, and the exhaustion that I think a lot of us felt afterwards. You know, I remember I was not really a smoker, but during that period, I was standing outside the building smoking cigarettes with our editor on a regular basis.
I remember that.
You know, I didn't know what else to do, you know, and our editor and I would sit out there and be like, what craziness is going to come at us today? We better, like, you know, smoke a few cigarettes before we go back inside. Anyway, it was a rough period of time for everybody. Obviously, the people who were actually hurt by it, average Americans, had it tougher than we did because we kept our jobs. Did you ever get screamed and yelled at by executives when you were covering this? I just remember one particular bad morning, and this was during the period where Morgan Stanley was in a lot of trouble, and they were talking to different institutions about mergers and the possibility that we need to be saved. And I wrote something with our colleague Eric Dash, and I'm not gonna throw Eric under the bus, we love Eric, but there was an error in the top of it, and I got a call from Tom Nides early in the morning saying, you are going to kill Morgan Stanley. This is going to be your fault if Morgan Stanley fails. And that freaked the F out of me.
Right. No, I would get regularly screaming calls. By the way, screaming calls from the bank, screaming calls from some of the political leaders and policymakers and regulators at that time. The stakes were just so much higher. And I just remember as we were reporting all this, any time that you'd want to report that an investor was pulling their money from a particular institution or there was any kind of semblance of a lack of trust in something, the ramifications of doing that were huge because it was going to have an echo effect everywhere. And if you were reading that and happened to be an investor in the same firm, you'd call up and say, I need to take my money from them too. And so the responsibility of all of this was, not to say it was greater than it typically should be, but it was so acute and it was so apparent in a way that maybe it isn't normally.
Yeah, I mean, even if you were reporting things that were true, you could be construed as pouring oil on a burning fire.
Absolutely.
That the confidence can drain away so quickly. Right. One story can make that happen.
I once had a former general come up to me, this is about a year after, and he said, Andrew, I don't think you appreciate it. You were covering a war. It's like a financial war. But what you did was terrible because he said, you know, if we were on our way to Fallujah, I remember this conversation. If we were on our way to Fallujah and you reported that we were going there tomorrow, that would be treason.
Right.
And he said, you were doing that every day. You were doing that every single day to the banks. And it was a very interesting perspective to think about. And I remember thinking, we're supposed to be in the business of transparency.
Yeah.
You know, people who criticize mark-to-market accounting, I would say if you believe in mark-to-market accounting, then you believe in transparency. You know, you have to have these things out there. But at the same time, I absolutely appreciate the other side of that argument.
Right. That even if they are true, by writing them, you are going to create a self-fulfilling scenario in which confidence is lost in an institution and everybody flees and then they go under. But at the same time, we have to report the facts. It's a really challenging environment to operate in. And any even slight mistake, it's magnified 10,000 times. Like, you just could not afford to make mistakes. And in this instance, we did make something of a mistake, and it was mortifying to me at that time. All right, I know you don't have a lot of time, so let's do like a lightning round of questions on the crisis, after the crisis. Do you think that this crisis in the aftermath and the Great Recession gave rise to populist politics and the rise of Donald Trump? Does it explain it entirely?
No doubt. It completely. Straight line. You know, there's a number of studies out there. You can read them. Literally, after every financial crisis anywhere, the electorate becomes radicalized. That's what happens. People become angry. They go to their opposite ends of the boxing ring, if you will. I would argue the rise of Bernie Sanders. Same story. Elizabeth Warren, to some degree. Same story. The fact that Trump won, I don't know if it's Trump versus somebody else, but Trump versus Hillary Clinton, absolutely. Hillary Clinton was the de facto, she was the system that everybody was voting against.
Right. Let me ask you about Jamie Dimon for a second since I have you here.
Please.
And we're talking about Trump. Very candid moment for Jamie in this event at JP Morgan a week or so ago, where he said, I could beat Donald Trump because I'm tougher than him and I'm smarter than him. And then he really stuck the knife into one of Trump's weakest spots and said, I made my money. Trump got his from daddy. Now, you and I talk to Jamie regularly off the record, and this sounds like Jamie, the kind of stuff he says. Doesn't usually say it in a public forum on the record. As quickly,
I cannot acknowledge whether I talk to him on or off the record.
I'm being much more free and easy with my on the record, off the record stuff here. I talk to everybody off the record. So does Andrew. Did it surprise you that he said that publicly?
I was surprised that he said it publicly. I think there's no question that for many years, people at JP Morgan and people around Jamie have questioned whether he wants to run for president. What are really his political aspirations? He clearly has real misgivings about President Trump. And my reporting would suggest that he has made that relatively clear to most of the people that are around him. Having said that, for the past year or two, in most of his public proclamations and statements, he's actually been relatively positive about the president, in part because I think he didn't want to become the target of a tweet storm, which, of course, he became. I would say the one distinction between him and Trump is he apologized and quickly went back.
He did.
On what he had to say.
Right. About Why do you think he did that?
Because he was worried about the second tweet that was probably, was probably ready to press send.
Yes. Although I must say, I thought Trump's response was, for him, relatively tepid.
It was. It was.
Which we could go into many theories for why that is, and Trump's relationship to Wall Street and his kind of, you know, being on the outside looking in and want to be taken seriously by major bankers. He's always had that kind of sort of inferiority complex. Quickly on Jamie, even if he wanted to run, do you see any path for him to the presidency?
I think it's tough. I mean, the real question right now is within the Democratic Party, among the CEO set that people talk about, whether it's Michael Bloomberg or Howard Schultz or Jamie Dimon, these are people who are true, closer to being centrist, if you will. And then on the other side, obviously, the Elizabeth Warrens of the world and Bernie Sanders, and sort of where the party really ends up. Is it possible that the party moves so far left throughout the campaign that at some point someone says, you know what, we got to find a centrist now, and that some one of these types of names emerges in a much stronger way? But today, I think it would still be very tough, especially, by the way, I was even surprised at just how much vitriol there still is about the financial crisis 10 years later. I'm happy that Twitter is not a real life place that you can live in, but if it would truly be a hellscape.
Yes.
Because even last week, the amount of anger was so palpable, and I think that to this very day pervades the entire conversation.
Are we safer today than we were pre-crisis?
I think we're absolutely safer today. There's no question to me that the capital requirements, more than anything else, more than anything that is in Dodd-Frank, have made things materially better. I'm not worried about financial crisis that emanates from the classic version of Wall Street that we know today. I am worried about the shadow banking system, where so much of the loans and leverage has moved. I think that's real. And if you do believe the debt is the thing that lights the fire every single time, I'm worried about states and municipalities and countries. And given the trade conversations going on in the world and the lack of trust, talking about the lack of trust across the board, that's what I worry about. And that can create a real crisis.
Indeed, it could. Andrew Ross Sorkin, author of Too Big to Fail. Also, are you executive producer of Billions? Tell us your role in Billions.
Co-creator and producer.
Great show. You should be watching on Showtime. New York Times columnist, co-host of CNBC Squawk Box. All around awesome guy. Check out Andrew Ross Sorkin, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
Victoria Guida recently published a story for Politico, and the headline reads, "Where Others Saw Misery in Financial Crisis,
Trump's Team Saw Payoff."
Victoria, welcome once again to Politico Money.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
So during the financial crisis 10 years ago, millions of average Americans lost their livelihood and homes. Meanwhile, there were some who were not having the same experience. They were seeing a big payoff. Victoria, let's look at the flip side. What was Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary now, doing back then?
Yeah, so there was a thrift called IndyMac, which was one of the largest mortgage lenders in the country at that point, and it failed spectacularly. And the FDIC was very eager for a buyer, and it found one in Steven Mnuchin and a team of other investors that included names like John Paulson and George Soros, which people have heard of. And they basically flipped this bank. They bought it, had it for a few years, put it back on its feet, renamed it One West, and then sold it at a profit in 2015.
So was anything that Mnuchin was doing here wrong?
No, morality is complicated, but, you know, it was completely legal. You know, the FDIC was certainly happy to have a buyer because they needed someone to take these toxic assets. You know, there were all of these foreclosures in the pipeline at IndyMac, and someone needed to deal with them. So, from the perspective of the government, this was a positive. It is notable that the FDIC did share a majority of the losses as part of the IndyMac deal. So it was a capitalistic deal, but it was also with government assistance.
Obviously, they wanted somebody to buy this thing so it wouldn't completely collapse. I don't know. Do you think there's anything immoral here? It certainly was opportunistic and cashing in on a crisis when people are suffering.
Yeah. So I think it's really interesting food for thought about capitalism because, you know, on the one hand, this is sort of precisely how capitalism is supposed to work, right? When we're in a down market, people will buy, and that's how things ultimately get turned back around. But it is also interesting to consider the fact that Steven Mnuchin is now Secretary of the Treasury. And, you know, I think it's worth thinking about whether, you know, he approaches that job more as a businessman or more as a policymaker. And, you know, I'm not really saying it's one way or the other. But, you know, when it comes to business, you want people to make the most efficient decisions, which is not necessarily what's best for every individual person. Whereas when you're trying to make policy, you want to think about things that help as many people as possible. And I should also note that, I'm not just ragging on the Trump administration. I think that this is probably a problem that policymakers have had sort of for all time, that they tend to be richer and, maybe more out of touch with what the average American goes through.
Okay, so let's go through the roster of Trump-era officials who made a bunch of money during the financial crisis. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, what did he do?
Right, so he actually bought multiple or invested in multiple failed banks. The biggest was Bank United, which was a Florida-based bank, and he was part of an investment team. He was sort of more of a passive investor than Mnuchin was, but he was part of a team that included Blackstone, which is obviously a very prominent private equity firm. And that's, you know, pretty consistent with his entire career. I mean, he's famous for being a sort of a steel magnate, for buying up failed steel companies and putting them together. So that's sort of his MO is buying bankrupt companies and flipping them.
Right. So this is where it gets into definitional issues. People would call him a vulture swooping in and picking over nearly dead carcasses. Mm-hmm. Others would call him somewhat of a saint for buying failing companies. But anyway, let's keep going down the roster. What about Gary Cohn, senior economic advisor to Trump until recently and former president of Goldman Sachs? Talk to me about his experience during the financial crisis.
Right. So his role is probably a little bit more well known. He was president and I believe co-COO of Goldman Sachs at the time. And so he oversaw, you know, this period of time in which Goldman Sachs, like everybody else, was by everybody else, I mean, all of the other investment banks and financial institutions were running into troubles because they were heavily invested in mortgage-backed securities. But Goldman sort of uniquely benefited from the fact that they also happened to be betting against the mortgage market, which was pretty controversial at the time because they were basically betting against a lot of their customers. So that ultimately helped them weather the crisis a lot better than their competitors because they had their short on the mortgage market to balance out all the money they were losing on the other side of the ledger.
Didn't Gary famously brag about making a ton of money shorting the mortgage market for Goldman Sachs?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And, there were sort of these emails between the executives that I quote in the story where their bet against the mortgage market was offsetting all of their losses on the other side of the ledger. And the CFO responded, tells you what might be happening to people who don't have the Big Short.
All right. So what about Trump himself? You know, he certainly had some commentary about what to do in a down market. But what really happened to him during the crisis?
Yeah. So Trump, obviously, a ton of real estate investments. The biggest thing that happened to him was he had just completed construction on Trump Tower, Chicago. And there were still a significant number. I think local reports put it about 25% of those residences in Trump Tower, Chicago, hadn't been sold when the crisis hit. And so Trump found himself very deeply in debt. He had taken out a $640 million loan from Deutsche Bank, and he was on the hook for $40 million of that himself. And so he ultimately sued Deutsche, saying that they had been engaged in predatory lending. And he basically said that he shouldn't be required to pay until after the crisis, because the financial crisis was basically akin to an act of God. So he did not ultimately get the payment that he was seeking from Deutsche, but he did ultimately get a 5-year extension in 2010, and he was able to sell the remaining residences. So He came out okay, but certainly not the windfall that some of his advisors had.
So let's get into what was perhaps weirdest and maybe the most troubling. Not that any of these guys did anything wrong or illegal, but you know, the whole rise of Donald Trump came out of the financial crisis. Distrust of elites, distrust of anyone in finance and Wall Street. And Trump certainly rode that wave into this incredibly surprising election win on the backs of people who were very frustrated with the establishment. And then he goes out there and hires a bunch of people who come from the establishment, who come from Wall Street, and who made a whole bunch of money during the financial crisis when everybody else was losing their shirts. So that, to me, is where some of the contradiction lies. And the thing I always come back to and remember is Trump's closing out of the campaign. That added dark footage of Goldman Sachs buildings. There was George Soros invoked. And he tried to sell himself, or his campaign did, as anti-Goldman Sachs, anti-Wall Street. And then he turns around and hires Goldman Sachs as president, as his number one economic advisor, and then touted what a great thing it was when he was doing it. It seems, at least to me, that he wasn't really serious about being anti-establishment, but we'll let people make up their own minds about that.
Yeah, I mean, this has sort of been the story of the Trump administration in the financial space, right? Is he campaigned on being basically anti-Wall Street, but since he's come in, he's been relatively pro-Wall Street. I mean, all of the things that he has done, you think about tax cuts, you think about deregulation, you think about, you know, the people that he's put in at the financial regulatory agencies. You know, these are people who by and large are responsible, thoughtful people who are nonetheless inclined to, you know, lean more Wall Street's way than, let's say, the regulators were under Obama. So It's definitely very interesting the way that this is all shaken out. And I think the other thing that's interesting is his base doesn't really totally seem to mind, although I feel like you do see some anger. Like after Gary Cohn left, I feel like, you know, his base really had no issue saying, well, you know, we never liked that guy anyway. So I guess it's sort of like, you know, his base trusts him to do what's right. And you know, I'm sure that they would say, well, you know, it's great that the president is putting people in there who understand business and know what they're doing. So it is very strange to sort of hold those two different ideas in your head, where on the one hand, they were angry at Wall Street, but then on the other hand, you know, their guy is sort of bringing in some, you know, people who are minted on Wall Street.
So, Victoria, what did Wilbur Ross predict the day before the Lehman meltdown?
He said there will be opportunities, and he was pointing to he said he thought there could be as many as 1,000 small banks that failed. And I don't know off the top of my head actually how many banks that failed, but it was more than that. Yeah, he invested in multiple of them. And the thing that's actually really interesting is the two different investor groups that we talked about, Ross's investor group and Mnuchin's investor group, I believe were the only investor groups that bought banks, because if you think about it, usually failed banks are bought by other banks. And so this was a very rare instance in which that didn't happen. And so that's another kind of interesting storyline, is you happen to have two people involved in these types of deals, and they both ended up in the Trump administration.
All right, Victoria, awesome story. Everyone should go read it on politico.com or on your mobile device. Thanks again for being our guest on Politico Money.
Thank you so much.
And that's a wrap for this week's Politico Money. Thanks to my producer, Jenny Ament. And our executive producer is Dave Shaw. If you're liking the show, please do subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Rate us and write a written review. We'll be back with you next week.